Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
My name is Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bean. And on today's episode, we gush over the timeless classic, The Princess Bride. Of course, the characters and acting are amazing, but more than anything, we're fascinated by the film's commentary on fairy tales and the ability for stories to transcend and connect generations.
Movies. Great movies.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we are gathered to talk about a great movie.
Man, I would love... I'm not a church-going fellow, but I would attend a church where you're the preacher and you introduce sermons that way.
Just the church of film.
Ah, man, that's a great idea. Like, that should be the end goal of Film Colossus, is to make a church for film. And you're the head priest, and I'm just like, I'm an altar boy, but I help.
Yeah, and we don't have service on Sunday. We have service Thursday nights.
Yep.
We do a whole service, and then we watch a new release movie.
And we do Thursday nights because in the future, I assume we're going to finally have a universal standard four-day work week. So Thursday nights when you party.
Oh, yeah. That always confused me when I got to college and everybody was partying on Thursday night. I was like, don't you all still have class on Friday? Why is Thursday such a go hard day? And it was like that all 4 years. It was like that when I studied abroad in Australia. Thursday. It was. Man.
I remember my senior year, although I'm blanking on it now. I actually can't remember. I either had class 2 days a week or 3 days a week. It might have just been Tuesday, Thursday. But every weekend was a 4 day weekend.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's a great schedule you had.
Yeah. When you get to that point and you know you can just like, you're doing the bare minimum to get through, like that's when you know you've made it.
Oh, yeah. Senior year of college can be a great time.
Oh, man. I had a great film class that you took at night. Like you would like travel across campus and like you'd go for 3 hours once a week. We watched a lot of good movies in that class. I remember that's where I first saw Suspiria.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite classes too. I think we had 1 day of, or 2 days of classes and one night that was the movie night each week. And there was a Cinematheque near campus as well. Mm. And sometimes we'd see a movie in like Cinematheque. So I got to see Seven Samurai like that. The first time I saw it was like on the big screen.
That's badass.
It was really cool. And then Princess Bride, the movie that we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
I watched it the first time, the most miserable way that you could watch a movie, which was on the little wheeled-in TV in high school.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It was in like a literature class or something?
Yeah, it was like sophomore year, I think, or junior year. And the teacher wanted to show us Princess Bride and, you know, in Ohio, in Canal Fulton, Ohio, in 2003, 2004, you still had the wheeled-in TV on the cart that was just a boxy-ass TV that was probably bought in the early 90s.
They had that in every state, 80s. Chris. It wasn't an Ohio thing.
I know. But I feel like some people listening to this probably had, you know, flat-screen TVs that were mounted in the classroom.
Maybe these days.
But we did not have that. So wheeled in, wash it on there.
I mean,
and I remember...
Ohio definitely still has those box TVs.
Oh, 1,000%. I remember how excited other kids in the class were about watching Princess Bride, and I really identified with Fred Savage because
you didn't want to watch it.
Yeah, before the movie, I was just like, it's called The Princess Bride. Like, okay, this is going to be, like, stupid. And especially I saw the cover, and I was like, that's not, like, an interesting cover. This is going to be lame.
This sounds like Chris Today.
Yeah. I read cool fantasy books because at that point, I was reading, you know, Game of Thrones when nobody knew what Game of Thrones was. I was reading Stephen King's Dark Tower series. I was reading...
I remember that.
A bunch of other fantasy books, like The Sword of Truth, Wheel of Time. Well, more people know Wheel of Time now, but the good version of Wheel of Time, all kinds of things. So I'm like, Princess Bride. And I watched it and was just enamored completely.
Oh, really?
First, like from the very beginning, I felt very seen by Fred, by the initial Fred Savage scene. And I was just like, oh. They knew.
And you were a Wonder Years fan, so like you were really in it.
I did like Wonder Years. It was one of those shows that I had a period of liking it, but I fell out of watching it like pretty quickly.
I remember really loving it, but I don't think I ever watched the show in order, you know? Like it was always just on Nick at Night or whatever, and I would catch it and always enjoyed it.
I remember watching, I think, episodes live. When was the show on?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, probably... I mean, it would have been like late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Right?
Wonder Years. Yeah, 88 to 93. I remember watching some new episodes when it was airing live. Anyway, Fred Savage, I always thought was cool.
Yeah, it's great.
But I don't think at that point, I mean, I knew what frame narratives were, but I think it kind of blew my mind, the use of the frame narrative in this movie.
Yeah.
And reminded me in some ways of like a less intense version of The Neverending Story.
Mm-hmm.
But that similar, like, real world kid gets swept up in a tale of the fantasy.
That was kind of an aesthetic back then.
Yeah. So I remember watching it in school and like loving it, buying it on DVD almost immediately.
Huh.
After that, and so I had the DVD of it, and then it was something that I think we watched like 2 to 3 more times in high school in just different classes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it got shown.
Interesting.
Got shown a lot.
Wow.
And there were times, I think there was at least one time, like the class voted to watch it.
And you voted as well.
At that point, yeah. Just be like, hell yeah, I'll watch Princess Bride
again. In this literature class, did you read The Princess Bride, the original novel?
There's a novel.
Oh, wow. All right, we got a lot to get into.
Yeah, no, I had no idea.
Okay, because to me, that's a fascinating part of this discussion. But I am interested to hear, is there more to Princess Bride in your life? Like, I'm sitting here surprised because I'm the one who picked The Princess Bride. And I'm someone who does not have a history of this movie at all. Like, I know a lot of people love it. It's a huge part of many people's lives, but I feel like if it is a huge part of someone's life, like I hear about it and know about it, and I've never heard you talk about this movie. So it's really surprising to me to hear that you've seen it several times. And this was, I would say, my first official viewing of the movie.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think I've watched it more than 5 times. Less than 10 times, though it was one that was in a rotation where I just used to put movies on throughout the day while I'd work. So I've seen it a lot in that way. But yeah, I've definitely seen it like approaching 10 times, but it has been a long time. Like, I think this might have been the first time I've watched it in the 8 years I've lived in Austin.
And do you remember it as well as you thought you would?
To the point where like I was still quoting a lot of things before they happened. There were a few things that I didn't quite remember as well, or was like oh yeah, there are eels. Like, I remembered the eels before we got to the eels, but I had forgotten kind of like a little bit of that scene, or like the quicksand and being like, oh man, she just fell into quicksand.
She really goes in there.
Yeah, just like straight down. So yeah, for the most part, I recalled pretty much everything.
Nice. Yeah. So I had seen this movie. Like, I think it played on Comedy Central, I think, or like TNT or USA, who knows? But I have this feeling it played on Comedy Central. And I had definitely seen like scenes from the movie. Like, while I watched this movie with my wife, I bought it on 4K, the Criterion Collection 4K, and was excited to watch it. It was like finally going to be like my first official viewing of the movie, of this movie everybody loves. But my memory of the movie was always kind of like, it's just kind of ordinary, you know?
Yeah.
It's just a straightforward movie. It's a fairy tale movie. I just was never enlivened by the premise of it, and I never thought it would be something I'd connect to that deeply, but wanted to watch it. Like, thought it would be interesting, like all the people in it. And my wife is a huge fan of the movie. She watched it a ton growing up, knows all of the lines in the movie. She my wife was, she was reflecting on the movie, and she's like, oh man, like in that moment where Dread, the man in black, is wearing the mask and you don't know who's in the mask. And like, I just remember not knowing who it was and wondering, I was just like, really? Like, you didn't know it was Cary Elwes? Like, it's clearly him. And then she was like, I think I knew, but I liked pretending that I didn't know. Which I feel like that alone perfectly captures what this movie was to kids. Like, it has that air. Like, it's just kind of fun and light and plays with the fairy tale formula in a very engaging way. It's like participatory in that way. Like, you're hearing the story being read and you're really part of these characters, and like, you're not supposed to know things, but you really do know what's going to happen because it's all tropes and it's all the standard structure for this romantic fairy tale story, blah blah blah. But anyway, heading into this viewing, I wanted to enjoy it, assumed that I wouldn't love it. I liked owning it on 4K, especially since like my wife loves it, and I assume I'm going to be watching a lot with my kids and stuff. So having it on 4K was important to me. But beyond that, I was like, am I going to really like it that much? And so, yeah, that was my mentality heading into this viewing.
Oh, man. And is it something that your wife, you would hear like your wife and your siblings like quote it or refer to it a lot?
So I realized as I was watching this movie, while we were watching it, there were moments I was like, oh, like that's why your dad says that. Like, what does the guy say? The priest, when he's marrying them, he goes, marriage.
Marriage.
Yeah. Yeah. Her dad would always say that. And like, I had no idea what I meant.
Oh man, so you're just like, why does this guy say marriage all funny?
I guess I knew it was from a movie and maybe was even told at one point, but wouldn't remember that it, what movie it was from, you know.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, it would be a strange movie just to see like bits and pieces of. I much like Lauren did not realize on first watch that it was Wesley, but
really?
I mean, I had to have known. Like,
Cary Elwes, only one person has that chin, and it's Cary Elwes.
Yeah, like, the eyes are similar, but there was just something, like, I remember how the moment I fell in love with the movie was when she pushes him down the hill, and he is rolling and goes,
As you wish. Pretty good.
And she just flings herself down the hill after him.
I know, those stunt people better have gotten a raise for that performance.
I hope so, because that was
dangerous. Well, it reminded me of the scene in Hot Rod when he tumbles down.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Just over and over. Like, it was also the ridiculous moment I fell in love with Hot Rod.
Yeah, that's easily the best scene in Hot Rod.
But there was just something about that moment that I recall being like, oh my goodness, like just it having that lasting effect. And part of that would probably be the reveal of, oh my God, it's Wesley.
Right.
But it's clearly, I mean, I was watching it this time. I was like, how does it, she know it's Wesley? Like,
I know.
So I hope I wasn't that silly as like a 16-year-old. But also at the same time, you know, it's a small TV.
Oh, yeah. You can't really see his total. You were probably in the back of the room, too.
I always sat in the front.
Chris, just say you're in the back of the room.
Yeah. Be cool. Be cool. But still, small-ass TV.
Yeah. We're in Ohio, so it's smaller than your usual box TV in a classroom.
Yeah. And it was definitely... It had to have been a DVD, right? It wasn't a VHS. It might have been a VHS.
In the 90s, you're probably watching a VHS.
Oh, this was 2003.
Oh, 2003. Okay. Yeah, so you're right on the edge. It could have been a DVD.
It could have been. Indeed, it could have been a VHS.
It's Ohio. It was a VHS.
It was.
It could have been a Laserdisc. You're in Ohio.
What, there's some song about Cleveland, like Cleveland tourism video, and it's like, where you can buy a house for the price of a VCR.
but you won't be able to buy a VCR to put in that house.
No,
you used all your money on the house.
Yeah, went to the house. Okay, so what did you think on this viewing?
When I did pick this movie for the show, like I wondered, I did have a fear of like, is this a good movie to pick? Because A, I didn't know if you were a fan of the movie. Now that I know you're a fan of the movie, that's good. Like I feel like we can nap the people who have always been a fan of the movie, and you could just hear someone like geek out about the movie, you know. But I am on the other end where like I don't even know this movie. I don't know all of the quotes, even though I actually did know some of the quotes as it was going, like, you know, the Inigo Montoya. I was like, oh yeah, I've heard that before. But I kind of wondered like, it does this movie warrant the kind of discussion we do in this show? Because we could obviously just talk about the characters and how the movie explores the characters and its story and all that. But on a broader level, like I'm thinking about something like RoboCop, where there's an external element to talk about, the satire and its commentary and all that, you know? I was like, is the Princess Bride going to have anything like that? And the framing device definitely sets the stage for there to be a deeper discussion. But as the movie carried on, I really started to realize how much there is to talk about with this movie and how it actually is really smart and is making really smart commentary on storytelling and fairy tales and true love. Like it actually has a really deep message about, you know, true love and beyond how it's presented in fairy tales and all that. And so as it kept going on, I realized how good it was and that it's not just a movie for kids and remembering the kind of movie you just remember from when you were a kid. Like it's for adults in that way. It actually challenges you and has interesting things to say and has characters that transcend the archetypes we see in fairy tales, and in that way it's challenging. And so yeah, I like, while I'm watching it, it's so effortlessly enjoyable that I was like, wow, like I don't know if I've seen a movie like this in a long time. And then in retrospect, the more and more I've thought about it, especially as I've read more about William Goldman and his original novel and what he intended to do with the book and then with the movie, he wrote the screenplay for the movie, I've just been really fascinated by this movie. And I don't think it's fair to say I love it in the way like someone who watched it as a kid can love it, you know, like that's a special connection, but I really, really do love it, and I can't wait to watch it more and more, especially with my kids.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
that's awesome to hear, because as I was watching, I was like, there's just no way that Travis isn't laughing at all of this, or like endeared by some of this dialogue and some of these like moments. I still think the thing that jumps out to me in thinking about like the kinds of discussions that we have on the show, it just comes down mostly to like a lot of the structure and setups and payoffs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thematic stuff, there definitely is stuff to get into, but the thing that's always impressed me a bit more has been just how this movie was written. And what you're saying too about it's not just for kids, you get that even in the initial dynamic between Fred Savage and Peter Falk, which just what great casting in the sense that like Fred Savage at that point was kind of this like it kid. Oh no, this came out before Wonder Years, didn't it? Like Wonder Years
started, it would have been before, in
88. So at this point, like he wasn't even an it kid, but he's embodying like the child perspective. Yeah. And even me, when I was 15, 16 watching this, I identified with Fred Savage. And then as an adult, you know, I feel much more on, or even after watching it the first time, you identify more with Peter Falk, right?
Yeah, totally.
Because it's not just the youth and the old age, it's the innocence versus experienced, where Fred Savage is so innocent in the sense of he doesn't know what he's in for. And Peter Falk is experienced not just in terms of being the grandpa and like wiser, but he knows the story and how good the story is. And that's the same experience that people are going to have with the movie, where they tell a friend like, oh, you haven't watched Princess Bride? They feel like the Peter Falk character. And like the friend that they're showing it to, or the family member they're showing it to, is the Fred Savage. Like Lauren was the Peter Falk.
Right.
Right.
And totally.
You were the Fred Savage. And now you get to be the Peter Falk from now on.
Yeah. Which is funny because she is the Columbo of our relationship. She's always problem solving and I'm just in here like, huh?
Yeah. You think you're done with the discussion. She starts to walk away and she turns around and she goes, one more thing though. One more thing. Ah, Columbo humor. Something that I've always wanted on this show that we've just never had the opportunity.
It's for all the Gen Zers out there who definitely know who Columbo is.
Yeah. Wasn't there somebody that was posting like Columbo episodes to TikTok? And it was becoming like...
Good. Give that person a thing. Like any sort of award we can give them.
I know. It's just Columbo's such a... My dad watched it all the time. And I remember feeling very Fred Savage about it. And be like, oh, what is this? This guy in a coat?
Yeah, I have memories of it too.
Yeah. Oh, he's smart. Like he's going to figure it out. Like he already knows.
I was an Encyclopedia Brown fan, but same thing.
Same thing. Of course. Of course. Yeah, but having that structure, and then the thing that gets me each time is just how entertaining the chase is, where Wesley's chasing down Vizzini.
Yeah,
just the three trials that he faces, the way in which Inigo is so charming, the way that Physic is so charming, it's really entertaining seeing the different tests that he has to overcome. And it's a very much a fairy tale trope, but the characters make it dynamic. The sword fighting, I remember crazy. That was one of the things where I was just like, oh, they're like,
well, do you know the story behind the sword fighting?
No.
Okay, so I mean, it's not much of a story. Actually, it's really cool. Like, that's them, you know, that's Cary Elwes and Mandy Patinkin doing the sword fighting, and they knew nothing about sword fighting before going into this. So like they each practiced their moves and they went to do it. And Rob Reiner, once they got the set, Rob Reiner, the director, was just like blown away by how good they were at it. Like he didn't expect that. He thought it would be a little bit more of like kind of a careless throwaway, like comical sword fight, I guess. But like they were good. And he's like, oh, like we need to do more with this. So they extended the sword scene and they found out whatever the longest sword dueling scene was in a movie. And they're like, we're going to go longer than that, like 1 second longer than that.
Wow.
And so, yeah, they just kept working on it. And like they would kind of like improv a little bit. Like, they would, like, they would basically be forming the sword fight as they went and, like, figuring out how to play with the environment. Like, when they got, when he gets pushed up against the boulders and, like, one falls off the side of the cliff, you know? Like, that wasn't originally part of it. It was something they decided to work in. And yeah, so it's just amazing that it is so entertaining because you have these awesome actors talking the whole time it's going on. But the fact that they're doing it well, like, I mean, it was just the, I say this a lot in the show, this sort of sentiment, but it was this moment you're like, you don't see modern movies do that kind of thing anymore, do you? Like, it was just so practical and real in a way that I appreciated.
Yeah, and a thing that I harp on a lot, not a lot of cuts.
Yeah.
Which meant that you were very immersed in the fact that they were the ones doing this. And you got to actually appreciate the fact that not only did he just do that move, but we saw the sequence of moves all in one shot, which meant they were all like, they were performing that rather than it being like a cut to the swords clashing, to the face, to a spin, to this, that. And that does not do the same thing for me that just like the simplicity of the filmmaking that brings out the high quality of the performance. A big tractor just went by outside my window. So I was distracted by what it was and how long it's going to be there.
Well, I mean, you're totally right. Like, I you have talked about that a lot in the show and how you appreciate like a lack of cuts, which I can go either way. Like, if a scene is done well and there are lots of cuts, like, there's a certain beauty and fluidity to something like that I think in the right movie, you know, in the right context and setting, thrives. But in this kind of movie, like, that kind of scene wouldn't work. It really helps to just let this duel play out, like, let them talk in real time. Like, it gains so much power by having that fairy tale feel. It's part of the aesthetic.
Yeah. So, and totally. the practical the thing about modern movies don't do this was also like top of mind for me as well. It, just with them rolling down the hill, it was something else where it's just like, it's a movie that felt like very lived in that way, or very lived rather than performed, which I think that's what jumps out to me a lot about some modern movies, is that with how much green screen there is, with how much CGI there is, it feels a little more theatrical than what the allure that like movies have for me a lot of the time in terms of being immersed in an actual place and seeing actual things done, where the stage can be very immersive in a way as well, but you're pretending that they're at a location. You're pretending that it's not just a theater with a stage and you're in the room looking around. There's a different quality to that. And movies never, I didn't feel that movies had that quality as much until very recently, especially watching so many old movies as of late. It's just hitting me harder and harder. Totally. And this one is definitely one that has that kind of impact with just how practical so much of it is, and you just feel like there are people with a camera out and about doing things.
Yeah,
and that's impressive.
I feel like this movie came out, like, I don't have enough examples to back this up, but like, just thinking about all the movies I've watched and like when they were made, this movie feels like it came out at a time when that sort of, there was a transition away from that. Like, movies were becoming less and less practical and feeling real. And I guess the way I would put it is less pretentious and more concerned with like product and like maybe lots of cuts is like one way to put it, but less concerned with creating something just like magical, you know, like transcendent and fairy tale esque. Like, there, I feel like there were just less and less movies like that. And I was watching the special features for this movie, and Rob Reiner talks about how like he always wanted to turn The Princess Bride into a movie. It was released in 1973 as a novel, and he always wanted to do it, but never could get it made. Like, studios would always say, like, no, like, we can't do that. It's too corny. It's too cheesy. It's a fairy tale. Like, that kind of thing doesn't work in a movie. And that's, in turn, like, what makes it work so well, because you don't see movies do this. Movies, like, there is a little bit of an air of pompousness to a lot of movies in that way, and that they would never just be as naked as this movie is, like, as so appealing to, like, a child's mind, you know, like, so simple. So that's what makes it really hit. That's what makes it so engaging, is that it is really simple. it isn't concerned with having, like, this grand overarching message that isn't just kind of screamed at you by the characters and by the framing device of the film. Like, you kind of get what it's doing. And because you get what it's doing, I think in turn is what makes it so deep and so engaging and so easy to engage with and comprehend. Like, when those things are done, when you just kind of wear what you are on your sleeve, that's what can make a movie thrive. Movies can be ambiguous. They can be deeper in quotes and smart in another way, but there's no reason a movie can't be smart in this way. And I feel like that is especially apparent these days in modern film, the last, like, 5 to 10 years. Like, you would almost never see a movie be like this, you know? Like, it's taboo to do anything like this. You have to go through all of these hoops, and you have to, I'm thinking of Midsommar. We just watched Midsommar. Like, that's the kind of movie that studios want and people are looking for more these days, you know? And something like this is seen as silly.
I feel like movies like this have been, storytelling like this has been relegated mostly to Disney and Pixar or DreamWorks. Like, a lot of the animated movies.
But even
will still have, like, Turning Red was one that I watched last year,
mm-hmm,
that just charmed me to, yeah, no end. And I was just like, this is such, like, a nice, straightforward kind of thing, but it's relegated to this kind of, you know,
lesser
CGI, yeah, like, animated film, because it's easier to make rather than, right, to go the practical route and spend all the extra money on the actors and everything. Like, even Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem for this year, like, pretty obvious in what it's doing, but it's so smart and enjoyable and dynamic and cool. It's a great movie, but it's another one that's, like, it has to be in the animated category to have that kind of opportunity. Right. It is a shame. Maybe I'm missing out on a bunch of, like, wonderful, like, live action movies that bridge the gap between, like, kids and adults. But if there's, like, another Princess Bride out there, I don't think I've seen it.
Yeah. And I think another huge reason I was connecting with this movie and thinking about movies these days and what I don't like about movies these days is, so, Chris, you didn't know there was an original novel for this.
No. Yeah. Tell me about this.
The original novel by William Goldman, who wrote the screenplay for the movie, is called The Princess Bride, : S. Morgenstern's classic tale of true love and high adventure, the good parts version. And he originally wrote this book. He's written several books and written other screenplays. But for this book, he asked his daughters, like, what do you want my next story to be about? And one of them said princesses, and one of them said, like, one said a princess and one said a bride. So he just went, okay, it'll be called The Princess Bride. And it kind of, like, that alone, really, that story alone informs what kind of story it is. Like, it's so typical, like, the title The Princess Bride, like, it makes it just seem so obvious that it's a fairy tale book, that you've read this a million times, you know what it's gonna be, and that it shouldn't catch your attention. And the book very much plays with that idea, because it's not just a book. Archer loves Princess Bride, by the way. The truck going.
I tried muting my microphone, but still going.
This is what live podcasting is all about, as far as I'm concerned.
I know. This is the beauty. This is the pain.
But so the book itself, like, it is commenting on fairy tales in that way, because it's not just somebody. It's not just the story of Buttercup and Wesley. It has the framing device that the movie has, but it does it in a different way. It's the book is being read by a guy who loved The Princess Bride, this book, The Princess Bride, as a kid. The Princess Bride isn't a real book. Like, everything in the book is made up. But his dad used to read him The Princess Bride. But what he didn't know is that his dad would cut out all of the boring parts. Like, all of the political commentary, all of the exposition. He would just read the good parts. So that was the approach with the novel. It's called The Good Parts Version. Is that he's telling this story. He's now reflecting on this story as an adult and just talking about the good parts of the book. So that's in turn what the movie becomes. And you even see Peter Falk's character in the movie doing that. Like, he'll like skip ahead, like past some parts in the book. Like, he's just skipping through the good parts to keep his son engaged. And I just really love the idea of that, because to me, the biggest detriment to movies these days, the least sexy thing a movie can possibly do, is just overwhelming me with dumb exposition, meaningless conversation. Like, I thought of Midsommar while watching this. Like, I thought of that scene where, is her name Danny? The Florence Pugh's character?
Sure.
I think that's her name. When her boyfriend and the other guy are, like, arguing about their dissertation or whatever.
Yeah.
And that scene lasts like 5 minutes. They're just sitting there like arguing, like, you knew I wanted to do this. And the guy's like, well, we can both do it. And it's a completely useless conversation that means nothing, adds nothing, and is boring to watch. And like, I just can't help but think, like, so many movies these days indulge in that way of just stuff that is not interesting to me. And it really made me appreciate Princess Bride, that it is literally the good parts. Like, it just shows you the stuff you care about, like people interacting with each other and achieving catharsis and realizing things about themselves and reconnecting. Like, every part in this, like, you can have all of those parts and still give us the information we need that we would get in any expository scenes. Like, it just is concerned solely with entertaining you while giving you a good story that has all the parts that make it deep and make you think about it and reflect on yourself and all that. So I love that that was the goal with the book originally, and then, like, that's how he translated it to the movie. Like, he's kind of switched the concept a little bit by having, like, the granddad reading to the grandson, but still, like, keeps the spirit of that idea and writing a book for his own daughters in a smart, engaging way, over, like, here are just the parts that are going to make you interested and entertained and all that.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure, with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Yeah, I mean, that comparison to Midsommar, it just has me thinking. Like, that scene, you're supposed to get that Christian is a dick, not only to Danny, but also to his friends, which is, I guess, supposed to set up us feeling okay about him eventually.
Interesting approach.
Yeah. Die. But the real flaw, I don't even think, is is the scene going on for so long. It's the way in which the movie fails to handle its secondary characters in any kind of meaningful way. Like the story with, I forget, it's not the actor from The Good Place, is it?
I don't think so. Like the main guy in The Good Place, like her romantic pair.
Yeah, William Jackson Harper.
Is it really him?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wait. Yeah. Cheaty.
Nice. I did not realize that. I've never really watched The Good Place, so.
It's fantastic. Like, I heard other people say it's fantastic, and I was like, no. I Princess Bride'd it. I was like, no, it's not. And then we watched, I was just like, that is one of the smartest, most enjoyable shows.
I'm sure it's well done.
Probably
I like
last,
everybody
like,
in
15
it.
Years. Yeah, it's wonderful. It like the best part is that it doesn't stay stuck in the typical like network comedy tropes of just we have to keep everybody in the same place. It's not afraid to keep changing things up and expanding while also deepening its core messaging and like where it's taking the characters. It's very phenomenal.
Nice.
But like Josh's character in the film, Midsommar, just doesn't do anything. It's like he's excited to go. He gets told by Christian that Christian's like gonna take this topic, and then he breaks into a room and is a dick himself, and they kill him. So it's just
deep
like,
stuff.
Yeah, you compare that to like Inigo's story in this.
Ugh.
And just that singular arc of I'm trying to find the man who killed my father, and the payoff to that and the power of that, it's so well done. Or
yeah.
Just like the mini arc with Vizek or Vizini, of just him being so arrogant and the comeuppance that he has. Like Vizini's in what 10-15 minutes of this movie, and you know so much more about him than any of the secondary characters in Midsommar.
And it's played by Wallace Shawn, who can outact any of those people from Midsommar.
He's also like rocking the V-neck in this.
Hell yeah.
Like, even though Wallace Shawn was definitely older when this movie was made, he was in his 40s. He like looks good with that like open chested shirt, like being all arrogance, like,
man, I love Wallace Shawn.
Yeah,
he's a fucking star in this movie. Like, he's only in the movie. You're right. Like, he's barely in the movie, but he owns every second.
Yeah, it's just amazing the dialogue he has. Like the the characterization of actually kind of coming off as like pretty smart, but then revealing like the various aspects of being a tyrant, being a dick, and then being so stupid by the end.
Yeah,
and some of the thematic takeaway that you can take from like the performance aspects of what he's doing, but also overthinking and the true like intelligence of Wesley in comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact that it presents the puzzle of which glass is the poison in, and us sitting there being like, which one's he gonna pick? Which one is it? Da 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 da. Only for it to be both.
Yeah.
It's such a nice little like twist of, oh, of course. And he just had built up a tolerance to the poison. Like, that's the trick.
Yeah.
The other thing I was thinking about with this was the reveal of Wesley.
Mm-hmm. Which you were surprised by, as well as my wife.
Yeah. As children. But
sure, you definitely didn't still think it was him.
No. I feel like a worse movie actually would have indulged in that a lot longer.
Yeah.
And tried to make that mystery more of a central point of the film.
Yeah.
Rather than just being like, all right, like 30 minutes in, we're going to like make the reveal. You all kind of know, but now we're going to move on to the next thing.
Only the good parts.
Yeah. It's just one of those things that I think makes this movie so enjoyable is that it's a series of events. Like, truly, rather than getting bogged down in just the one thing and dragging that out for a period of time, it's a number of different chapters and journeys and instances that keep it having that sense of momentum and giving it all of these different dynamics and aspects that allow it to dip a toe in different genres, to highlight different characters, have different settings and like moments that stand out because they are part of just a brief arc or chapter of this film.
Yeah.
I think that's an underutilized technique in some movies.
Totally. Yeah. I was thinking about a lot of the, like, all the kind of stuff you're saying about the actual story with these characters, like the story that the grandfather's reading. Heading into this movie, I was like, how much can we really talk about? Like, even if the movie's really well done, if these characters, like, all we're really going to do is gush at how well it did. And it is kind of what we're doing. But it like, it's really hard to capture just how well it does it. Like, it transcends in a way that movies that are clearly trying so much harder to do and trying to throw in all these things, like you saying a lesser movie would have kept The Man in Black a secret longer. Like, almost every movie in the world would do that. Like, every movie ever does that kind of thing and draws something out, which makes you realize like how kind of stupid it is when something like The Princess Bride just abandons it immediately and gets to the good part where like they're back together. Like, that's what you want. Like, you want to see these people together. Like, that's what engages you. That's where you see yourself and can love these characters, like being back together. Like, that's what movies and stories are all about, is these sort of uplifting, transcendent moments that bring people together. It's just really amazing how effortlessly the movie does that with pretty much every single important character. Like, they all achieve catharsis. They all get what they need, and they all thwart like the shitty people who need to be vanquished. It's awesome.
Yeah. The story that you talked about, like in the novel version, kind of the frame mm-hmm. narrative and the commentary, it reminds me of a book I read called Pale Fire. Oh, it reminds me of a couple things. There's Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov.
Yeah, I think you've told me about this. You must have just told me about this movie, about this book, because that'd be the only way I'd know about it.
Yeah, it was my senior thesis was, or my like thesis in college for like my major was on it. But it starts off with this guy saying that he's giving like a critical evaluation of a poem by John Shade.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts off very academic and then descends pretty quickly to where you're like, is this person mentally unwell? And then it's the poem by John Shade, which is like 30 pages. And then it's the critical commentary presented in a very academic way by the guy from the opening, but he's legitimately insane.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the way in which he like stalks John Shade and all of this background, and the narrative unfolds through this commentary on the poem. And so it keeps referring back to the poem, but then going off into tangents about what was happening as John Shade was writing the poem. It's pretty cool. But there's that. There's also Don Quixote has a lot of frame narratives. Like, most of Don Quixote is Don Quixote going somewhere, meeting somebody, and then them telling him a story. And you get the background, then they try to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very like Princess Bride-y in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the famous Borges short story, where it's somebody who rewrites. The short story is a critical analysis of somebody who rewrites Don Quixote from memory. But every single word is the same exact word as in the original Don Quixote. So it's almost just like a reprint. But the critic that's the focus of the story ends up praising the newer work as superior to the older one because it came out, you know, 200 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're putting it in context of what this story might be in reference to, it has to include 200 years of politics and history and right. events that the previous one didn't, which is pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
But it's interesting having those like very highbrow
yeah.
literary instances of that, and then seeing the way somebody used it for a much more friendly version of events to tell this story, but in a unique way of getting into it and around it and commenting on it that makes it very meta,
yeah,
while at the same time being very engaging.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, and I think the way this movie does it, like, obviously the framing device is a big part of it, but to me, it really clicked actually at the end of the movie when Peter Falk says, "As you wish," to Fred Savage.
Yeah.
Which, like, that moment, in the moment when I watched it, I was like, okay, like, cheesy way to end the movie. Like, that's, it's nice, but it just feels like such a thing a movie would do, you know? But upon reflection, like, it really is an incredible moment because, look, the story with, you know, Wesley and Buttercup, like, that entire story is so well done that it's hard to complain about it. And even the Cary Elwes, even Wesley saying, like, as you wish, like, and connecting it to Peter Falk, like, it seems so obvious. Yet when you think about what William Goldman's trying to accomplish with the movie, when he's only telling the good parts, when he just wanted to create a story that was commenting on fairy tales by having all of these characters that are seeming archetypes of what you typically experience in a fairy tale, but having them kind of transcend that and do things you wouldn't expect the characters to do, and taking the story above and beyond what you would typically expect from a story that's depicting true love, you know, like, that's such a central theme of the movie is true love. What does true love look like? The movie is trying so hard to convince you of, like, what true love is, that these people love each other more than anybody else in the world. Like, how do you accomplish something like that? And it's not really the point for the movie to make you believe that. Like, you do just because the story is so well done and you love the character so much that you're just like, fine, fuck it. Like, they love each other more than anybody. I love that. But I think the true kicker is when Peter Falk says, as you wish at the end, is that it's not real. The point isn't really to make you realize, oh, Wesley and Buttercup have true love. It's to show what stories can do, that this thing, this true love thing that's in the book, that can be replicated in real life. Like, when Peter Falk says, as you wish, it's him, much like Wesley expressing to Buttercup, like, his love for his grandson and his ability to show the power of stories and what they can do for, like, you know, a little sick kid, this kid who was rolling his eyes at a kissing scene and wants to hear it at the end. Like, he's exposing his kid to these things. And it's just such an incredible meta technique that shows the power of fairy tales more than just the fairy tale can do. Like, it brings it into the real world and shows, like, oh, like, this is true love. Like, it's not just something written on a page of two fictional characters. Like, these two people embody something very real that the grandfather is now recreating for his grandson and showing him something. That's just such an incredible thing to do, and, like, why this movie is so perfect, again, for both kids and adults, and why this kind of movie, to me, feels truly timeless in it. People always say, like, timeless, you know, it's used in, like, critical reviews, but, like, this movie's kind of timeless in that way. Like, is it ever not going to be relevant? Are people ever not going to be showing this movie to their kids and, like, forging that connection, and then those kids show the movie to their kids? Like, I feel like this is just going to be a cycle for forever.
And you kind of gave me goosebumps when talking about that, because it really is the core key thing, because everybody talks about with fairy tales, they are often parables, right?
Uh-huh.
You're supposed to take a lesson away from them, and some are just for entertainment, right? But, you know, you hear about Rumpelstiltskin or Pinocchio, there's always some kind of, like takeaway or lesson or real world application in the most famous of them. And even with movies, I think you sometimes get the dramatization. You're like, well, that's just the movie. But the framing device being in reality and the fantasy parts of the movie being so, like, within the real world of it,
mm-hmm.
allows us to have that degree of takeaway when Peter Falk says that, because it's the lesson that people if they just saw the fantasy elements, they'd be like, well, you know, that's an exaggerated take on true love. Real life isn't necessarily like that. Or, you know, there is a real life version of that, but you don't make the next connection.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's on you to make that next connection, which a lot of viewers may not do.
Right.
By just using the frame narrative to have Peter Falk deliver that line, it says everything. It tells everything while also showing. It's yeah. such a moment of not just, is it this lovely? And this is what love is between, you know, in the real world. You hear like the fantasy talk of it, but in the real world, it can be as simple as just showing up when someone you love is sick and reading them a story or spending time with them. Is it that lovely? But the actual direction that it's telling people and educating people of, these aren't just stories, but they're things that can have real world applications and things that you can bring into the real world,
yeah.
is also very meta and important and serves a point as well about just the beauty of storytelling and the power of storytelling. So on the one hand, the storytelling aspect doesn't matter at all. It's mostly just letting people know how you show love to people you care about in some subtle ways and what love in the real world looks like. But yeah. then there's also this meta storytelling element that's incredibly important and, as you said, timeless and relevant.
Yeah.
That's just so smart.
Yeah, that was, like, again, like the whole framing technique that happens right at the very beginning when you see the grandfather sitting down. I was kind of like, not rolling my eyes, but like, oh, I've seen this before. You know, it's nothing new necessarily. But man, the movie just does it so well. Like, that ended up being my connection to, like, I feel like, again, I don't want to say I can love this movie as much as someone who saw it when they were a kid, but like, I feel like I kind of do. Like, it made me, I didn't really grow up reading fairy tales. Like, I don't have memories of fairy tales being read to me. Do you really?
Yeah, we had some books. Like, I had a lot of the gold label books.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what they called them? And then we always had Christmas books that my like mom would read to me on Christmas Eve all the time.
Nice. Yeah, but so it made me like, I want to go out and buy some fairy tales. Like, I want to read them to my kids. Like, it's, I don't know, this movie has, it's just incredible that this movie has that kind of power.
It's a random aside, but one of my favorite books as a kid was called Little Blue Cat and the Smiley Worm Doll. And it was just about like these anthropomorphized like kid cats that all had their favorite toys. And, you know, one had a basketball, another had like a skateboard, whatever it was. And this one had a beat up smiley worm doll that it would carry around.
Mm-hmm.
And one day it loses it. And the story is it going all around, talking to its friends, talking to people in the town, and then having to like feel really sad about losing its smiley worm doll. And finally, I think it's his grandpa or just like, you know, old nice guy in town stitches him together a new one. And presents to him like a new smiley worm doll, but they also happen to find the old smiley worm doll. So then Little Blue Cat ends up with both the old and the new smiley worm dolls.
Right.
And my dog has a green dinosaur that was like a PetSmart $5, like donate to other dogs kind of thing. And I ended up donating one, but also buying one. And brought it home, and it's been his favorite toy for like multiple years, and it started to get really beat up, so I ordered another one off of eBay.
Mm-hmm.
And it came, and now he has both his like old green dino and his new green dino and carries like both of them around or like will swap between each of them.
Yeah,
but
I love that.
Yeah, fairy tales in like real life where you just see like, you know, a little blue cat and a smiley worm doll, and then you see like a real world dog and his green dino.
Random aside, my daughter's favorite toy does change a lot. She started getting into like stuffed animals in the last few months. And nice. For a while, Panda was her favorite, but currently her favorite is a purple platypus called Patty. And it Patty would absolutely platypus. Melt your heart to hear her say Patty and just like wonder where Patty's at. It's destroying me.
Oh, that's adorable. Yeah. Fairy tales.
So yeah, I I love this movie. I'm a fan of this movie now.
Good. Yeah, I mean, it hits. It works. Yeah. If it was just the fantasy, I don't think it would be... It would still be charming, but I don't think it would be, like, a classic.
No. I mean, yes, you're totally right. Like, it would just be like, wow, like, you can't believe all these people came together and did this. But the fact that it's a story being read and that, like, there are constant interruptions, which to me, in my mind, is part of fairy tales. Like, you read a fairy tale to a kid and, like, they stop you and ask questions. I don't know. This movie just has a certain energy that allows that story to... I don't know. It just hits a little bit more deeply.
Yeah. I really like Robin Wright's performance as well. Like, oh my gosh, she's the best. Her and, like, Carrie Elwes are just, like, so great in this.
Yeah.
Like, Carrie Elwes is still, like, so handsome. Like, when you watch this, it's just, like, the perfectly, like, chiseled face.
Totally.
And then Robin Wright's just, like, the perfect, just, like, country beauty.
Yeah.
But I was so much more entertained this time by Prince Humperdinck and Count Rugen. Where, like, Humperdinck, it was just cracking me up when he's doing the chase for Buttercup, because he's in on it. He's the one that hired Vizzini in the first place, right?
Right.
But as he's, like, going around and just saying, like, the grand statements of, like, if a hair is harmed on her head... and just being so, like, extra about it. And at first you might actually, like, take him seriously, but then now, having watched it so many times, you're just like, oh, what a little, like, performing piece of shit.
Right.
And then Christopher Guest. Count Rugen.
Oh my god. Yeah. Love Christopher. I mean, I already was a fan of him. I didn't even realize it was him at first. And something seemed familiar about that character. And then I looked it up and was like, oh, yeah, of course, it's Christopher Guest.
Yeah, he's just, the way he stares and plays such a, like, a creep is really entertaining. And then, of course, with Billy Crystal and Carol Kane coming in.
I had this feeling that, like, I know someone is, I remember the character of Miracle Max, I feel like, from TV. And I was like, oh, I feel like someone plays him. And the second I saw him, I just knew from his delivery, I was like, oh, that's Billy Crystal. And then I saw Carol Kane come in. I was like, oh, like, this is the best pairing ever.
I know. They just, like, it's such a brief scene. Yeah. And yet they're so they're so dynamic and high energy that it's just kind of pretty amazing.
Yeah, they destroyed it. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the Princess Bride.
It's the Princess Bride and a active corgi.
That's why people come to this show, though.
Absolutely.
To hear our dogs and daughters yelping in the background.
It's what makes us real, you know, down to earth, approachable.
Yeah. Not this fairy tale stuff you hear on all the other podcasts.
Oh, no. They act all perfect.
Yeah, they edit that stuff out. We keep it in, not because we're lazy, but because we want it to feel real.
Yeah, no, not the laziness. No, at all.
Yeah, of course we could edit it out, but we have more, you know, we want this podcast to have that feel.
We have integrity.
Integrity. I couldn't think of a word.
We're not hiding.
I was just floating in the ether there for a second. Okay. So time to rank this, right?
Yeah. Completely forgot about that.
I will go first. Okay. When I first watched this movie, I was like, all right, that was great. I really liked it. Engaging. Good story. I like the framing device. Great movie. The more I thought about it, I was like, oh, man, like, this movie's actually doing quite a bit that's really interesting. And the more I think about it, the more I love it. And it was making me reflect on, like, certain scenes, you know, like the sword fight and all that. I was like, this movie is, like, actually pretty awesome. And after writing about the movie and now talking about it with you, I'm resolved to, like, this is, like, an all-time movie. Like, it's... Like, I know I'm going to keep watching this movie with my kids and stuff. And by the way, we didn't even talk about how gorgeous this movie looks. Like, watching it on 4K, just the use of like the scenery, like the mountains and fields, the theatrical sets that are being used, like it's just so pretty in a way that, again, makes me wish movies could do that these days. Like, I know I'm just going to keep watching this movie over and over, so I think I'm ready to just go ahead and upgrade it right now to like all-time status.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Figuring it out where it's on my list, I have a feeling it'll go higher with as time goes on, but I think right now I have it of the 498 movies on my list, almost at 500. And these are the movies, we're ranking all the movies we've watched since the start of, I'm ranking them anyway, of movies I've watched since the start of 2022. Chris's list started in July of 2022. So my list is almost up to 500 movies, and I'm going to put The Princess Bride. I just don't know how to put it, you know? Like, it's in good company with a lot of these movies here. I guess it's right around... I'm going to play it safe for now, which is my way of saying, like, I don't want to put it too high because I'm riding a high right now and, like, love this movie. So I'm going to be conservative and put it at number 63.
Okay. That's pretty good. What tier is that in?
This is in the transcendent tier. Like, this is... basically, anything in this tier and above are like, I'm like, okay, these are like my favorite movies. Like, these are the ones I know that are going to be part of my life. Like, these are the kinds of movies where, like, there are movies that are superb that I'm like, oh, this is above and beyond what I expect the movie to be. And then there are movies that really hit and connect where I'm like, ooh, this like feels part of my DNA now. Like, I know this represents something about me and how I look at the world and what I really want out of movies and all that. So it's in that category.
Okay, nice.
And the sandwich.
Sandwich.
This is an interesting one. We got Fast X at the top, followed by The Fate of the Furious. I know Chris will love that. Then The Princess Bride, then Groundhog Day, then Eyes Wide Shut.
Man, that is quite a sandwich of movies.
That's, yeah, I would eat that on a... on a hot summer day.
They're all pretty fun. Except Eyes Wide Shut, which is just like the odd man out in there.
Yeah,
which is fun in a completely different way.
They're all very adult movies though.
Yeah, oh, of course. Nothing more adult than Fate of the Furious.
Yeah, so Chris, what do you got?
So I revamped my list a little bit. I now have, it used to just be like Colossal was the top tier, and that was a mix of ones that I really liked, but also just ones that, you know, appealed to my sense of scope and scale. But mm-hmm. I've since revamped the top of the list to be my favorites, which kind of transcend everything else.
Yeah.
And then Wow is the stuff that really impressed me, but it's not going into the favorites category.
Sure.
So some of the stuff that's like in my favorites might be less like good in quotes. And some of the stuff in like the Wow part, like I have Cloverfield above All Quiet on the Western Front. Like, I don't think Cloverfield is better than All Quiet on the Western Front, but I like Cloverfield more.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah. So I currently have 172 movies. And my favorites category has 16 right now, and The Princess Bride goes into it.
Nice.
So I have it at number 14, and the sandwich above it is Past Lives at 12, then The Wailing, then The Princess Bride, followed by Cloverfield, and then a 2015 indie movie called Too Late.
Too Late?
Huh. Yeah, it's this cool John Hawks movie. I think I told you about it when it came out. Like, I saw it at Fantastic Fest in 2015, but it's four different chapters or five different chapters that are each like 20 to 30 minutes and or maybe like 20 minutes, and they're all one shots each one.
Okay, that sounds very Chris Lambert.
Yeah, and it's very like murder mystery but it's so inventive. The camera work is so cool, the acting is so impressive because they are in that one shot the whole time. It's a really well done and cool movie, but it recently played at the Draft House here in Austin. Huh? The filmmaker was there. So it was cool to get to go see it on the big screen again for the first time in 8 years.
Wow. Yeah. I love, I have movies like that in my like top tier that I'm like, yeah, I know this movie isn't better than Apocalypse Now, but like it is. I think one of those movies I'm going to pick as my next movie next time when I get to pick.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay. So I can't decide. There's like five movies that I've been wanting to rewatch, and I think I'm going to let you pick which of those five we do.
Okay.
Though I do have one that I'm kind of leaning towards, but so it's Marketa Lazarova.
Oh, wow.
Melancholia. Schenectady, New York. Wings of Desire. Or I guess that's it. Those four.
Okay. All movies I've seen. I watched Melancholia. To me, that's the most obvious pick because I feel like maybe there's the most to talk about. And maybe like I have the most connection to, but I did watch that one most recently. And then Marketa Lazarova, what were the other two?
Wings of Desire and Schenectady, New York.
Schenectady, New York could be interesting because I remember not loving it, but I also am a Charlie Kaufman fan and wonder if I just need to watch it again. I would love to pick Marketa Lazarova and just nobody knows what we're talking about as we talk about it. But I also really want to watch that movie again too. So, what are you leaning towards?
Melancholia was the one I was leaning towards because
I mean it's awesome.
I think the only one of these that I've seen twice is Wings of Desire. But Melancholia is one that's like really stuck with me over the years. I mean, they all have, but it's one that I've been like really kind of anticipating. But at the same time, like these other ones have also been creeping in the back of my head.
Man, Lars von Trier, like his last few movies to me have been incredible. Maybe starting with Melancholia. Like, I feel like he figured out something there. I mean, yeah, let's watch Melancholia.
All right, Melancholia it is.
I'm happy to revisit it.
Cool. Sweet.
And then we should probably write about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
1,000%.
Okay. Well, get ready for the fun and exciting Melancholia, everybody.
Nothing like going from the Princess Bride to Melancholia.
Actually, I'm glad we're doing this because I feel like this always happens with Lars von Trier's movies that I watch it, I know I connect with it, but I can't always tell why I connect with it. Like it's not that the movie is ambiguous or anything. It's just that like, I don't know, but it takes like a second viewing or like reading about it for me to be like, oh, like that's my in with that movie. So it'll be nice to revisit it.
Hell yeah.
Sweet. Okay. Chris.
Oh man.
Are you ready?
I'm ready. Are you ready?
Okay. So I don't know if I told you this. Did I tell you this? I don't remember if I did, but last time we tried to do this, we're both trying to say see ya at the same time, essentially. And last time I listened back to the podcast and it sounded like we pretty much said it at the same time. In your mind, you don't think we ever do, though.
No, in my mind, we clearly don't.
So I don't know what's happening here. Like the movie gods, like maybe they're mad because I don't like Midsommar and they make sure we don't time up at the same, you know, line up at the same time. But last time, as far as I can tell, we said it right at the same time. So I think we can do it again.
Liar. Okay. I'm down. Let's do this.
There's evidence, Chris. You can go listen to the episode.
Okay.
But sure. Okay. But I will also say that it doesn't really matter what the episode says, like it has to feel right. It has to feel like we said at the same time.
That's true.
So okay. here we go.
Okay.
All right. Everybody quiet on set. They already knew they'd be quiet. Okay, here we go. Yeah. Lights.
Camera.
See ya.
See ya.
See, yeah.
I'll give it to you. That was better.
That was better.